Art meets history, meets a new audience now. Oscar-winning Disney animator Sarah Ayres is our guest. Frozen, Winnie the Pooh, Wreck-It Ralph, the Academy Award-winning Paper Man, and Simon's Cat are all on Sarah's CV. But she has swapped Frozen for freezing. She's put Sunset Strip on ice for Antarctica, the setting for a series of graphic novels retelling the story of the earliest explorers to the South Pole. Based on Captain Robert Falcon Scott's teammate, Apsley Cherry Garrard's memoir of their ill-fated 1912 expedition, which he called the worst journey in the world. Sarah's adaptation is breathing new life and love into it, drawing it onto the page for the sake of a new generation of readers. As a spin-off, Sarah has also penned The Best Journey in the World about her own experience of coming to and working on this adaptation. Sarah is with us from Cambridge in the UK to tell us that story. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello.
Getting late then where you are.
Hello. Oh, yes, it's quite late. That's fine.
The story of how you came to be working on this, it's been delightfully told through your blog, and I'd like to sort of recapture it here because, my, what a career you had. And what was the pathway into that career? A natural creative, always someone who drew to express? What was the path?
Yeah, I've always loved reading and I've always loved drawing. And so it was a natural thing for me to draw what I was reading. The pictures in my head from the reading, and then I make them on the page, or at least try to. It's very frustrating. You should try to put on a paper what you see in your head. So animation was kind of the logical choice once I discovered that people actually became animators. And really from about the age of 14, that was what I wanted to do. So I read all about what you needed to do to become an animator and did it and had an actual career out of it.
Grew up in Vancouver, I think. And I'm just thinking for your age, who would have been, like, what would have been the early role models or examples you had when you began drawing as a child and then getting serious about it as a teen?
Well, I grew up with the Disney movies of the 90s, so those musicals. It was The Hunchback of Notre Dame that really got me into animation, and a lot of my favorite animators, who ended up becoming my favorite animators, worked on that film. So it was their work, really, that I was trying to emulate. They would be horrified by that. They're like, no, no, look at the masters, don't look at us. But they're amazing, and that's who I learned from, really.
Not all animation is the same. And were you what we call 2D animation? Just to explain, I guess, a bit of a snapshot, really, of how the profession has evolved and how it was you did what you did.
Right. So I was, as I said, I wanted to go into animation because of the drawing side of it. So 2D animation is just doing a series of drawings like a flip book that make the character move and talk and whatever. So I went to school for that for 2 years. And the spring that I graduated, Disney decided that they were shutting down their 2D department because everyone wanted to see Shrek and Toy Story, which is CG animation, which is done with sort of models in the computer, sort of like a puppet in the computer. So I thought, well, there goes my dream of being a 2D animator. I wasn't interested in CG because it wasn't drawing. I like drawing. So I got other jobs working on CG productions like character design and that kind of stuff. But in 2007, Disney announced that they were restarting their 2D department and they needed new people for it because there's kind of a generational lag there. So they were looking for new animators to come join them and learn the craft from the old animators and hopefully carry on the grand tradition of 2D Disney animation, but that didn't last very long.
Well, it seemed at the time like an incredible opportunity, and you mm-hmm. must have your eyes must have just lit up. What did it open?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What did it open up for you? What followed?
Well, I've come to think of it now as sort of a PhD in animation because I was working with the best in the world, learning. You know, I knew how to animate, but learning how to really make it good. And there were so many classes available, life drawing and painting and acting and whatever. It was just an incredible education. And I happened to also work on a couple of movies while I was there, which was great.
How does that work. Let's pick, say, there was The Princess and the Frog, 2009, Winnie the Pooh, the beloved Winnie the Pooh in 2011, and work on others as well. But how does that actual process work within a massive operation like the production of a film under Disney? How does it all pull together?
Yeah, it's funny because back in the 90s when they were turning out these films once a year, it was a really well-oiled machine, but it had been kind of rusting in a corner for a while by the time we took it back up again. So it was fun to see how they were, you know, trying to relearn what they had done so well before. It's honestly just a lot of organization by people who don't get any credit. The production people are amazing with, you know, herding the cats of the animation department, but it's a fairly established route from, you know, storyboards where you figure out the script and the staging, and then that goes into layout and that goes into animation, then you make everything move, and then it goes from that to other departments where things get colored, and it's kind of a production line, but each step along the way contributing something artistic, and at the end you have a movie.
Paper Man was the short film and the first Disney animation to win an Academy in over four decades for the reasons you've just been explaining. What was your role on it?
So on Paper Man, I was one of the two leads for the department that put the lines on the characters. So the characters were animated in CG, looking like Toy Story. And then another pass was done on top of the CG, working in the line work to give that expressive quality that was lost when things went to being like a virtual model. Because line work, especially that loose brush type of line that you have in Paper Man, can really add a lot of expression and the feeling of, you know, the stretch of the clothing, and you really get the tension of the pose through that. So they didn't want to lose that. They wanted to bring that, fold that into the CG animation. And so myself and Hyunmin Lee oversaw that department, which was a very technical, it sounds really simple, just draw over the CG, but it was actually a very technical process that we were kind of wrangling this program that was sort of half written and working with the programmer and saying, can we have a button that does this? And then the next morning there would be a button that did that. It was really fun and very different from anything I'd done in animation before.
Well, Frozen, of course, the most famous, it just seemed to be ubiquitous, and so did the darn song. And
yeah, I've been listening to that song 6 months longer than everyone else.
Did you have expectations, even as people worked on it, did you have expectations that you were onto something that would so connect with so many children and families?
You know, I have to say, for my own part, that was a bit of a surprise. It was kind of just another movie. It was like, oh, it's, you know, Tangled 2, this time with snow. So I mean, it's cool, it's amazing that it really hit with people. I don't know, there's lightning in a bottle somehow.
There's a sort of a cynical humor to it that children often appreciate. There's a fine line between the throwaway line and something that they find funny and something that they don't, and it seemed to hit the mark with that.
Okay. It's really good to hear something from an end user perspective, because we're working on this stuff years before anyone else sees it. So, and we don't really get that feedback from people who actually have seen the film and like it and can say why. It's just like, by then we're working on something else. So that's really cool. Thank you.
Let's look at the diversity of your skills before we get into the new project, because there's everything from the sophistication of the cooperation with CG that we've been talking about to something as simple and loved as Simon's cat. I think we've got a link on the page. The simple black and white animation. Is it a learned skill over a long time to have that kind of diversity?
Well, I guess it depends which school you go to. The school that I went to was training people to enter an industry that demanded that you be able to adapt to different styles. So we learned from day one in our character design class, okay, this week we're designing anime style. This week we're designing, you know, Family Guy style. So you're definitely expected to have that skill set. Some other schools train people to have more of a personal brand, and then you're expected to get hired on your brand. But for the sort of grunt work of animation, you're expected to be able to jump on a show and start delivering artwork in the right style.
Is there an imitation to animation? One thinks of you working on 2011's Winnie the Pooh. I mean, A.A. Milne's style, that beloved and instantly recognisable style of characters. Is imitation a particular talent as well?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because you'll have, you know, one or two art directors on a film, and then everyone else has to follow their lead. So whatever they decide, you know, oh, we're going to do a sketchy line on this one, and we're going to do this sort of shape language with the characters, is like, okay, well, that's what we're doing.
What brought the transition away and into this new challenge? You've said you gave up a lot of paycheck, and I bet it was at Disney, and have been living like a student again in England for this current project. I detect a certain ambivalence. I mean, we've learned a lot, haven't we, about big studios and their politics and the people who run them. But I detect a certain ambivalence. For all the opportunity, was there also a time to get out?
Yeah, it was. I had never really been very comfortable in California to begin with, and the gloss was coming off the job. And the culture clash was starting to come up a lot more. So that was difficult to deal with. And it also, I didn't really see a future for myself at the studio, because I was doing the same sort of work that I'd been doing in Vancouver in a city that I didn't like living in. And at that point, it's like, well, why not just move back to Vancouver and enjoy where I'm living and keep doing the same work and be happier? So I was kind of at a crisis point anyway. I actually heard the radio play that got me into the Terra Nova expedition the first year that I was at Disney. And it was just kind of sitting in the back of my head, like, I really like this. This is what I'm really interested in. I was acquiring books and kept pursuing the subject. But when I got to that crisis point at Disney was when I had kind of been fighting off this suspicion that I ought to make this into a graphic novel. And eventually it reached a point where I knew I had to make some sort of change. And I figured, you know what, this seems like the best time. I'm just going to try this. And if it doesn't work, then I will have tried. But I have to at least try it.
Sarah Ayres is our guest, the animator and graphic novelist. We are about to talk about this big new project that has so preoccupied her, telling the stories of the earliest explorers to the South Pole. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. So it was actually a radio play, listening to a radio play that so embedded itself in you. Had you known much about the polar explorers before that? What was it that made this such a trigger?
I hadn't known much. I had heard a radio documentary about Shackleton like 10 years previously, which introduced me to the two things I knew about Scott, which was that he was second to the pole and died on the way back. And that was it. That was the sum total of my knowledge. What really got me about the radio play was how wonderful all the people were. And I had had no idea about any of them as people. They were just sort of, you know, chess pieces that made the wrong moves. And the story was analyzed that way. But once I got to know them as people, I couldn't get enough of them. They were just wonderful, wonderful people. And that's what kept me reading and reading more and more, you know, the biographies and the journals and other people's accounts of the expedition. And I just had to spend more time with these people.
Just how far has that taken you, the research? It's taken you to the UK, and what's been involved in delving into the story as fully as you needed to tell it the way you wanted to?
Yeah, well, I mean, the obvious thing was going to the archives at the Scott Polar Research Institute. It's one of my favorite places in the world. Getting to read these wonderful people who I love so much, like getting to read their actual handwriting was amazing. And they have letters and diaries and stuff that haven't been published that you can't find anywhere else. So that has been incredible, not just getting different perspectives on the story of the expedition, but also getting to know kind of other facets of these people's lives and how that made them who they were and how that influenced what they did on the expedition and decisions they made and that sort of stuff. So getting a really full understanding of these people so that I can present them truthfully, because I love them how they are, and I want to do them full justice as best I can in these books.
What is actually Cherry Garrard's own story, the diary that guides you the most?
Yeah, he was in a very similar position to me when I started at Disney. He was kind of looking for his calling. He got this amazing opportunity. He kind of had to drop everything and run for it, and you know, was having the time of his life for the first year or so of the expedition. Just couldn't imagine anything better in the world. And then everything kind of fell apart and fell down around him and ended up being not what he had expected when he set out. And I sympathize with that hard. We're also rather similar people. It's kind of uncanny sometimes, you know, his reactions to things are my reactions to things. So I felt like I understood him from the inside in a funny sort of way. And then being in a similar position, obviously in my position, nobody died. But that kind of shattering of illusions and shattering of innocence.
Does that emotion help? Like you identify with him, you're almost vicariously with him on his internal journey. And does that help you as a storyteller?
Yeah, definitely. Because when you're trying to communicate an emotional journey to an audience to whom it is unknown, being able to feel that yourself and knowing where he's coming from, you know, you can try to communicate a story that you have no experience with, and you're just going to be sort of going through the motions. But when it's something that you feel deeply yourself, that comes through in the way you tell the story. And you can I want to say juice it up, but that sounds more artificial than it is. But, you know, inject a little extra oomph from personal experience.
He was the youngest member of the expedition, lived to tell the tale, and also a great fan of Rudyard Kipling. I think he took his whole collection with him to Antarctica.
Yes, he did.
So he was an interesting person, a rounded person.
Mm-hmm. No, he was very interesting. He was very keen on science, but not trained at all in science. So it's a sort of humanities person diving into the science world with a bunch of high-level scientists. So he's both out of his depth, but also really, really interested in everything, which is a great place for an observer. As someone, you know, as a writer, your job is an observer. And so he's kind of outside and inside at the same time. And I think that's what makes his writing so accessible, because he's not coming at it as an expert in his field like some of the other scientists were. Like if you read Griffith Taylor's book, he's a geologist first and foremost, and he will digress from anything to tell you about the geology. Whereas Cherry's coming at it as a human, you know, student of history and literature, and he's communicating the emotional side of things.
What were some moments in reading that diary where you really you had your aha moments as to what would be pivotal points in the graphic story? What were one or two that really touched you?
I'd have to say this is a strange moment to pin on, but the moment that made me most emotional when I encountered it for the first time was on his way back to the base camp from discovering the Polar Party's tent and learning what had happened to them. And whenever I introduce this story to somebody or meet someone who's just encountered it for the first time, their response is always, I will never complain about the cold again. And he actually writes in his diary, because it can get fairly warm in Antarctica, and inside your tent it's like a greenhouse and it collects heat. And he starts a journal entry by complaining about how hot it is in the tent. And then he stops himself and he says, but I'll never grumble about heat again. And it's sort of the flip side of that, where he's had that perspective of like heat is life and hope. And, you know, it's not emotional necessarily in the sense of the shattered innocence that I was talking about before, but it's a kind of hinge point where something has changed in him. And there's a wryness to it that you don't get in his very, very enthusiastic multiple exclamation mark, "Everything is so beautiful and amazing" journal entries from earlier in this story.
It's a moment of truth for him.
Yeah, it's this kind of introspection, realizing what's happened, I guess. He came out of the expedition very jaded and somewhat bitter, mostly just, you know, disillusioned, and he took it really hard. And that, I feel like that starts sneaking in at that little moment of like, you know what? Mm.
The jadedness, because one of the points you make about this expedition was there was an element of morals to decisions that were made, including mm-hmm. not giving people not giving themselves the best chance to survive. Yeah. So when you say jaded, was it with decisions that were made, or was it more just with a dream that turned into a reality that was a nightmare?
Yeah, I think it was there's a lot of earlier in the expedition, there's a lot of positive thinking, if I can make that a pejorative, just like, oh, just, you know, hope for the best and it'll all work out. And, you know, it's not like they didn't plan. They definitely planned, but the attitude was a little more jaunty than perhaps it should have been. And that is something that I can also sympathize with from working at Disney, working in California, where it's like, if you just don't think about the bad things, they won't happen. And then nobody's prepared when the bad things inevitably happen. So that's kind of another emotional point for the story. That's not why I want to tell it, but I feel like that's an important lesson for people. And his jadedness, his bitterness comes from that, you know, the destruction of positive thinking.
How important was it to go to Antarctica to be able to convey the story?
It was fundamentally important. I'd been told this. Everyone I talked to who'd been there says, you don't properly understand, you know, the decisions that were made, what it feels like to be there, the environment they were working in. Like, you cannot understand how the story goes until you've been there and experienced it yourself. And now that I've been there, I was like, yes, absolutely, you are correct. I cannot imagine sitting down and trying to draw this book without having walked around where they were.
So what did you experience when you went down there on one of their education and media programs, aren't they? What was it you experienced, yeah, particularly going to, say, some of the historic huts, the hut they headed out from?
Yeah, the huts were amazing. It, you know, I've seen so many photos, especially of the Cape Evans hut, but standing there and getting the sense of the space and how crowded it would have been when everyone was there, and hearing the wind soughing around the corners of the hut, and imagining, you know, nowadays it's, you know, an hour and a half snowmobile ride to Scott Bays from there. But back then, you had to walk everywhere, practically. They did have motor sledges, but they only went 3 miles an hour, so that's basically walking. And you were thousands of miles from the nearest person. It was the idea of this tiny little shed in the middle of nowhere. I never really got the proper perspective on that until I was there and standing up the hill from the Cape Evans hut, and you look out and there's gorgeous mountains and ice and skuas and the sun, and then there's this tiny little wooden shack down there that was the center of the universe for these people. And I really need to get that across in the book, that they are in the middle of nowhere. They're very vulnerable in this tiny little hut, and it to get across the scale of what they were up against. And that feeling of being, you know, we're here together. We can only support together. We are all any of us has at this point in time and space.
It is notoriously hard to illustrate Antarctica. It is just white. And there's nothing there. You mentioned the scar, the little gulls and there's enormous kind of walrus type creatures there as well, but there's not much else that can be seen. There's a heck of a lot under the ice, including all the bacteria, but and penguins, if you're lucky enough to see some Adelie penguins or some of the more regal larger species, but there's nothing there. And for you as an illustrator, was there a challenge in being able to draw what you've drawn? Some examples of which are on our webpage, listeners.
Well, there isn't nothing there. There's mountains. There's a giant volcano. That's very exciting.
It's all white, though.
There's... Well, it isn't, though. I realized when I started drawing... when I did the cover for The Best Journey in the World and I just put white down... for the snow, it looked like it was glowing, and then I looked at the actual photographs and it's almost never actually white. It's usually, even in brilliant sunshine in the middle of summer, it'll be, if you're looking at it at a slight angle, it'll be a sort of bluish purplish gray, and it's only if, you know, you're holding up a piece of snow and the sun is directly behind you, that's the only time it's actually white. The rest of the time it's reacting to various colors in the environment or changes of light, and you almost never have just this perfect white, shadowless sort of pool table experience. I think I saw that once while I was down there. It was cloudy and slightly snowing, but the clouds were thin and the sun was coming through, and it was that diffuse light. And that was the only time that the whole world looked white. The rest of the time, there was loads to look at and all sorts of interesting color things going on.
You must have been fortunate then to have the sun. And that may have made an enormous difference. But you also have an illustrator's eye and would see the variations in even a primary colour. Also, another advantage I imagine of going to the huts is just the detailed preservation work that's been done there. And was that welcome in trying to replicate as accurately as you can, some of the key
scenes?
It
was incredible. I have such profound respect for the Antarctic Heritage Trust. I mean, I've read so much about this stuff, and I feel like I know these people so well. And they put everything exactly where it needed to be, and people's items were on the right bunks, and it was, oh, I love them. And seeing, because having sort of collected photos for reference over the years, I've seen a lot of the hut in sort of the 90s. And then seeing what it looks like now is incredible. They've turned back the clock on this building and all its contents. I all my respect to them.
So where are you at? As we said, you've been blogging and you love involving people in various ways and watching the work unfold as well. There's so much now, of course, these days and undertaking a project with people being involved as well. But where are you at in the actual project and in getting the works finished?
Well, I'm still in early days. I've done probably most of the research. There's a few documents I still are on my to-do list to look at, but I feel pretty confident that I've got the information that I need. I'm three quarters of the way through drawing the first volume of four. I still need to color it and format the pages and, you know, make it ready for print. But I'm really enjoying the drawing. It's really, I mean, I've been looking forward to this for years now, being able to sit down and just do what I love, which is drawing the stuff that I read and getting to spend every day with these wonderful people. I mean, couldn't ask for anything more. That's coming along. This year has been insane, as everyone knows. But I think I'm set to get back into it. Kind of the big roadblocks seem to be mostly out of the way for now. We'll see. Who knows what will happen tomorrow? Anything could happen. It's 2020. It's crazy. But fingers crossed.
And it feels so long.
What
does a graphic novel do that a traditional novel can't with a story like this? And is it particularly beneficial for a certain demographic?
Well, what it does is it sort of bridges the gap between a book and a movie. where at least if you're coming at it from, you know, a cinematic perspective like I am, I worked in the movie industry, I want it to look like a movie. Lots of graphic novelists, you know, do actual things with the medium that you can't do in any other medium and probably have more artistic merit for doing so. But I just want to put a movie in people's heads, so I make it easy. And there's been so much written about the Terra Nova expedition. I know, I just moved all my books into a new house. There's a lot of books. But the visual telling of it has not really been done much. There's been a movie and a TV show, both of which had to edit the story substantially for running time and various other agendas. Whereas a graphic novel, you can go into more detail, and you're presenting it still in a cinematic way, where you can take people, you can use all the dark arts of film to take people on an emotional journey, to get to know the characters, and make them feel like they're there in a way that some people don't feel when reading, especially because a lot of the literature on this subject is kind of dry. I really like reading people's journals, but very few of them are, you know, really gripping seat of your pants type stuff. It's more like, I was examining ice crystals today and I saw that they formed in this way at this temperature.
Sarah, all the best with it. We've got the links up so that people can follow what you're doing on your blog. They can see where to donate to help the project keep running. There's some sample chapters available too. Thank you very, very much for your time and all the best with it.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful chat. I always love talking about Antarctica, so it's a wonderful excuse. Thank you.
Sarah Ayres. And those links are on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9 to noon.